Could you please state your full name?
Yes, it's Kathy Bidlock.
Can you spell that for the record?
C-A-T-H-Y-W-H-I-T-L-O-C-K.
And Dr. Whitlock, where do you live?
I live in Bozeman, Montana.
Have you been asked by the plaintiffs to serve as an expert witness on certain topics?
Yes.
Can you briefly describe those topics?
Yes, Dr. Running and I wrote an expert report looking at Earth's energy imbalance, looking at how greenhouse gases are driving climate change, and then looking at human-caused fossil fuel development and how it's harming Montana's ecosystems, water supplies, communities, and the youth plaintiffs.
And generally, did you also prepare a rebuttal report to the expert report of Dr. Judith Curry?
Yes, we did.
And can you, again, briefly talk about how you and Dr. Running divvied up who covers what in your expert reports?
Dr. Running provided a global overview of climate change, and I'm going to be talking about the effects of greenhouse gas emissions on climate change in Montana.
And Dr. Whitlock, can you please explain the portions of the expert report that you're going to focus on in your testimony today?
I'm talking about recent trends and future projections in temperature, precipitation, snowpack, snowmelt, and stream runoff in Montana. I'll be talking about the effects of climate change on ecosystems, communities, and the livelihoods of people that depend on those things. And I'll be talking about projections of climate change that are going to happen in the future for Montana as we increase greenhouse gas emissions.
And for purposes of your rebuttal report, did you discuss projected impacts of climate change?
Yes.
So let's hear now why you're qualified to testify on these topics. I'm going to exhibit P146. It's in your binder, if you could take it. Yes, please. Is that a true and correct copy of your CV?
Yes, it is.
Your Honor, I move exhibit P146 into evidence.
Judge, Your Honor.
P146 into evidence.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let's review the highlights of your CV, starting with your educational background, please.
I got my bachelor's in geology at Colorado College. And then for graduate school, I went to the University of Washington, where I studied geological and earth sciences. After I got my PhD, I was a postdoctoral research fellow at Trinity College, Dublin.
And briefly, can you talk about your work history after Trinity College, Dublin?
Yeah, my first position was at Carnegie Museum of Natural History in Pittsburgh. And then in 1990, I joined the faculty at University of Oregon in the Department of Geography. And I was department head there from 2000 to 2004. In 2004, I was lucky enough to come to Montana State University, where I became professor of earth sciences there. And I was professor through 2021 when I retired.
Can you describe your work history while you were at MSU?
While I was at MSU, one of the things is that I was the founding director of the Montana Institute on Ecosystems. And then in 2019, I became a Regents Professor, and now I'm a Regents Professor Emerita of Earth Sciences.
And while you, well, generally, do you have a primary area of research?
Yeah, I study climate change as it plays out over centuries and millennia, and I'm particularly interested in how ecosystems have been shaped by climate change.
How did your work dovetail with the work done by the Montana Institute of Ecosystems?
The Montana Institute on Ecosystems is kind of unique in the higher education system in the state because it has a base on both campuses, U of M at University of Montana and Montana State University. And there was an effort to bring together the environmental sciences and strengths of both campuses so that we could work together on projects that affected the state.
Have you worked on any reports regarding the effects of climate change on Montana?
I have. I was the lead author of the Montana Climate Assessment, which was published in 2017. In 2020, that developed the Montana Climate Solutions Plan. In 2021, we did a special report on climate change and human health in Montana. And in 2021, we also published an assessment on the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem.
Can you, and for purposes of the record, Your Honor, the Montana 2017 Climate Assessment is Exhibit P6. The 2021 Special Report is Exhibit P31. The Greater Yellowstone Climate Assessment is Exhibit P34. Dr. Whitlock, can you describe what the 2017 Montana Climate Assessment was?
The Montana Climate Assessment, like any assessment at the international or national level or state level, it's an effort to synthesize the best scientific information that's available at the time that it's produced. And the goal is to synthesize this information and present it in a way that everyone can understand. So this was a two-year effort on the part of a group of scientists. We had authors from the two universities, the Montana Climate Office, the Montana Water Center, federal and state agencies. We had authors from the tribes and authors from nonprofit or non-governmental organizations in producing it.
And for purposes of the data in the assessment, because you took 2 years, was the data through 2015?
Yes.
What periods of time were you looking at in the 2017 Montana Climate Assessment for purposes of projections for Montana?
Well, we started by looking from 1950 to 2015, and then we projected into the future, and we focused on the climate conditions at mid-century and end of century. So mid-century centers around 2050, and then went to 2100.
And was this 2017 Montana Climate Assessment shared with officials with the state?
Yes, we sent it to our U.S. congressional delegates. We sent it to the governor and his staff. We shared it with members of the state legislature and people that are in agencies. So it was widely dispersed across the state and distributed.
And did you personally give any presentations to government officials on the 2017 Montana Climate Assessment?
I did. I presented it to the governor and his staff. I presented it to meetings where legislatures were present. I presented it to the state interim water policy committee.
And Your Honor, earlier I neglected to identify Exhibit P36 as the Montana Climate Solutions Plan. Dr. Whitlock, can you describe the Montana Climate Solutions Plan?
Yeah, Governor Bullock formed a council of 40 members. These were leaders across the state and climate scientists produce a plan for Montana's future. The goal was to reach carbon neutral for the state by 2050. to increase community resilience to climate change and to outline various adaptation measures that the state could pursue.
Did the Montana Climate Solutions Plan make any recommendations?
It made 8 primary recommendations, and then there were more, there were minor, or not minor, but there were recommendations underneath those 8 categories.
For the next report, we're displaying the Montana Climate Assessment, Climate Change and Human Health in Montana. Can you describe what that special report was?
Yes, after the Montana Climate Assessment was released, I've been going around the state talking to different communities, and the healthcare professionals came to me while I was doing that and said, you've overlooked.
You want to...
Well, overall, I don't think it's the author of the book. It's just an aesthetic. Okay.
They came to me and they said that we were overlooking our greatest asset, and that's people and their health. And so with that, we got together with the healthcare community leaders and developed a special report that's part of the Montana Climate Assessment, looking at human health issues related to climate change. That was funded by the Montana Healthcare Foundation.
And was the Climate Change and Human Health in Montana report distributed to officials in the state government?
Yes, it was.
Can you describe essentially what the Greater Yellowstone Climate Assessment was?
The Greater Yellowstone Climate Assessment is an effort to look at climate change impacts in this 22 million acre ecosystem that surrounds Yellowstone National Park. It's the first time there's been a climate assessment of an ecosystem, and what a grand ecosystem it is. And for that, we worked with experts from the 3 states that are included in the ecosystem. So we have the 3 research universities, we had state organizations in putting that together.
And was this report, the Greater Yellowstone Climate Assessment, distributed to Montana state government officials?
It was, yes.
Your Honor, at this time, I'd move all of these reports into evidence, Exhibit P6, P36, P31, and P34.
My objection would be based upon relevance, because we're talking about the 2023 MEPA statute, which has only been in existence for 30 days. And hearsay, they are not, they do not meet the exception of public records and reports under Table 3, sub 8, because they are from, I think, the Montana Healthcare Foundation, exhibit P31. They were not, sanctioned by any government official, and there is no seal of approval. So based upon that, those would be my 2 objections. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Well, as far as the statute only being in effect for weeks, that was a clarification. The amendment was a clarification. I think what was going on before is clearly relevant. Mm-hmm. And I think we have substantial guarantees of trustworthiness as to these other documents, however you want to characterize them as some sort of learned research treatise or whatever. I mean, it is dead. And give me the numbers again.
Certainly, Your Honor. P6, P36, P31, and P34.
So P6, P31, P34, and P36 are amended.
Thank you, Your Honor. Dr. Whitlock, have you authored any books or peer-reviewed publications on your research topics?
Yes, I've published over 230 peer-reviewed scientific papers. I've co-edited a book on the topics of my research.
For purposes of the record, can you explain what a peer-reviewed report or publication is?
When a scientist writes a manuscript, and submits it to a reputable journal, it has to go out for peer review. So peer refers to experts in that field. So the manuscript gets sent out to experts that are anonymous to the authors. The experts look at the manuscript, evaluate its content, its accuracy, its relevance, and then recommend whether it should be published or not. And that's the peer review process. It's the same peer review type of process that happens with climate assessments.
And while we've talked about Montana reports that you've been involved in, has your research been all in Montana or has it been around the world?
Well, I've long worked in Montana on climate change issues and in the greater Yellowstone region as well. But I've traveled and worked around the world in some respects to compare it to what I know is happening and has happened in Montana. So I've worked in Patagonia, I've worked in New Zealand, I've worked in Tasmania, I've worked in Europe, I've worked in China, I've done some work in Russia.
Speaking of international work, are you planning on doing any international work in the near future?
Yeah, at the end of this week, I'm leaving for Mongolia, and I am co-teaching a course on climate change and human health in Mongolia over there.
And later on, today we're going to hear from Dr. Lori Byron. Will she be teaching with you?
Yes, indeed. She's one of the co-teachers as well.
So does that mean you'll be unavailable to testify here in rebuttal as to Dr. Curry or Dr. Anderson to the extent they testify in this case?
I imagine I will not be available.
So, Dr. Whitlock, can you again briefly describe your other professional service?
Yeah, for the National Academy of Science, I'm on the Board of Environmental Change and Society. I'm also a regular guest editor for the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, which is one of the lead journals in the country. I've been chair of the U.S. National Committee that looks at past climate change at international levels. I'm on the board of three journals now that are leading in my field, but I've also been on editorial boards of other journals. I'm past president of my professional society, which is the American Quaternary Association, and I've been on several national and international advisory committees concerned with climate change.
Have you been nationally and internationally recognized for your scholarly contributions and leadership activities?
Yes, in 2009, I've gotten the Meritorious Research Award for my university, and later I've gotten a Meritorious Outreach Award. In 2014, I got the Edmund O. Wilson Biodiversity Technology Pioneer Award. I was given in 2015 the Professional Excellence Award of the Association of American Geoscientists. I received the Distinguished Career Award from the American Quaternary Association. In 2018, I was elected to the National Academy of Sciences. In 2022, I received the Starker Leopold Award from Yellowstone National Park. And I'm also a fellow of the Geological Society of America and the American Association for the Advancement of Science.
And Dr. Whitlock, you mentioned that you were elected to the National Academy of Sciences. At the time you were elected, how many scientists from the University of Montana system were with the National Academy of Sciences?
There were none.
So you were the first one?
Yes.
Right. Are these awards that you've just listed, are they primarily due to your work on climate change?
Yes.
Now, given your distinguished career. How many times have you testified in court as an expert witness?
I've never testified in court.
Do you believe that your testimony in court, in this case, will be helpful in assisting the court to understand the evidence?
Yes, I hope so.
Are you charging the youth plaintiffs in this case for your time serving as an expert witness?
No, not at all.
In preparing for your testimony here today, did you consult primarily any written resources?
Yes, I consulted the Montana Climate Assessment, the Greater Yellowstone Climate Assessment, the Climate Change and Human Health Report. I consulted the scientific literature that's come out in recent years. I've looked at the new report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and also the National Climate Assessment. I also, of course, reviewed the plaintiff's complaint and the rebuttals.
Your Honor, yesterday, with Dr. Running, we marked the citations they referenced in their report as Exhibit 302. Just to give the court context. Now, in terms of the opinions that you're going to give today, for purposes of documents on that list, are there any additional documents that you relied on?
I think that list is pretty comprehensive.
Did you review the plaintiff's complaint?
I did review the plaintiff's complaint and also the rebuttals from Dr. Anderson and Dr. Curry.
In terms of the opinions you're going to express today on the impacts in Montana, are those opinions based on well-established science?
They are, yes.
How do you know?
Well, because the opinions come from a large array of scientific literature. The scientific literature has all been peer-reviewed. The assessments that I've been involved in have gone out for peer review at the highest level. That is, they've been reviewed nationally and anonymously, and we've responded to all of the comments that we received. So I feel very comfortable about the opinions that I'm expressing.
Can you describe the types of observations for purposes of the climate trends you're going to be testifying about in terms of your testimony on observations of the climate system?
Could you phrase that?
Sure. What data sources are you going to be using, like direct measurements?
Okay, so the information on the historical climate trends and in the Montana climate assessment, we'll start with 1950, comes from weather station data, snow tell data, snow measurement stations, stream gauges. So it's very much the observed data. And when you look into the future, then you're relying on projections that come from climate models.
Can you clarify whether, in your opinion, there's any doubt that the impacts in Montana about which you will testify are occurring?
There's no doubt.
Dr. Whitlock, were all the opinions expressed in your prior expert reports, were they based on a reasonable degree of scientific certainty?
Yes.
And will you please answer my questions today using that same reasonable degree of scientific certainty standard?
Yes.
Your Honor, we tender Dr. Whitlock as an expert on the topics she identified.
Yes, she's an expert.
So let's turn now, Dr. Whitlock, to the knowledge by the state of Montana of the dangers posed by fossil fuels and climate change. What are your opinions on this issue?
Well, Montana's climate has been warming steadily as a result of the burning of fossil fuels.
And based on your understanding, how long has the state been aware of anthropogenic climate change?
It's been aware of climate change for several decades. I think the first report produced by the state was the one that Dr. Running was involved in 2007.
And what generally do these reports conclude about the dangers posed by fossil fuels and climate change in Montana?
The 2007 report noted the rising temperatures and the acceleration of warming. It described reduced snowpack as a result. It talked about summer drought. It discussed the increase in wildfires that were occurring and were likely to occur.
And did it also include any projections on those points?
It projected, based on the best climate models, that those trends would continue and accelerate.
In terms of the 2007 plan, did it address the issue about the implications global warming could have on Montana's economy, environment, and quality of life?
Yes, you're showing a quote here that I think makes that very clear, that there are implications that global warming will have on the economy, the environment, and well-being in Montana.
You earlier spoke about there being a scientific consensus about climate change. Was that scientific consensus already true when the report was issued in 2007?
Yes, it was, for sure. The first IPCC report, that is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, was talking about climate change at the global level. The first report was in 1990. The National Climate Assessment, the first National Climate Assessment was in 2000. So there was already a record of climate change occurring.
Did the 2007 Climate Action Plan have any predictions about climate impacts in Montana?
Your Honor, very briefly, I'm going to make it very quiet. It's just going to be a standing objection as to weeding. I mean, literally, the sentence he wants her to testify to is flashed up in front of her before she's even asked a question. I just want a standing objection to weeding.
I understand the objection. I think you're asking for her expert reaction and opinion to these things.
So yes, Your Honor.
I will make the objection that it's a standing objection.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah, as I just said, the 2007 report talked about the continued warming in the future, the prolonged drought, the increase in wildfires, the loss of snowpack. All of those were covered in that report.
And in your opinion, did the predictions set forth in the 2007 Montana Climate Action Plan come true? In other words, is Montana experiencing these impacts?
It is, and more so.
So what do you mean by more so?
Well, we've seen warming at a greater rate. We've seen more wildfires. We've seen greater loss of snowpack. We've seen extreme droughts.
Let's turn now to the 2017 Montana Climate Assessment. Again, just to set the context for your next testimony, what did the 2017 Montana Climate Assessment look at?
Yeah, in that assessment, we covered climate change and then the impacts that it had on our water resources, on our forests, and on agriculture.
And again, to just briefly reiterate, it was data through 2015, is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
And the future was, in essence, mid-century to the end of the century.
Yeah, those were the two time periods we focused on in that assessment.
Did the 2017 Montana Climate Assessment look at impacts?
It did, yes.
And did the predictions that were presented in the 2017 Montana Climate Assessment come true?
Most of them have, or we're seeing most of them happening.
And did your work in this case rely heavily on this 2017 climate assessment?
It did, yes.
Let's step back for a moment. Can you please take a look at what we've got? We've got here a topographic map of Montana. Given Montana's geography and topography, how would you describe the climate?
Well, Montana is the fourth largest state in the nation, and it covers a wide range of latitudes. About 40% of Montana is in mountains and 60% is in high plains. And it ranges in elevation. The highest elevations are over 12,000 feet. And the lowest elevations are about 1,800 feet. So this range of latitudes and its location and its elevation sets it up for a very diverse climate. And what we see is that weather systems come from the Pacific. They come from the Arctic, which brings the really cold, dry conditions. And we also get some weather systems coming from the subtropics, especially in the summer and spring. May I go on?
Yes, please.
The Continental Divide is a real climate divider in the state. On the west side of the Continental Divide, that's the mountainous region. That area is strongly influenced by Pacific weather systems, Pacific storms. And most of the precipitation is received in the spring and the summer and the fall, although they do get some subtropical moisture in summer. So it's the winter, spring, and fall. East of the Continental Divide is much more arid because little of that Pacific moisture gets east of the mountains. And the weather east of the Continental Divide is strongly influenced by these subtropical systems. So these are the thunderstorms and the hailstorms and so on that we get in the spring and in the summer. It's a more semi-arid climate east of the Continental Divide.
I detected in your response that the time of precipitation is important. Is that correct?
The time of the precipitation in the state is highly variable, and it depends on where you are.
Let's go back to a concept of annual average temperatures. What's happened to temperatures in Montana?
Now, these are data from NOAA, and it's showing you the time period from 1900 to 2022. So that's the dates running along the horizontal axis. The average temperature over that period is shown by the horizontal black line. But what you can see is the year-to-year measurements. Those are the red lines, and they're going up and down through this data set. The trend or the sort of direction of those measurements is shown in the blue line. And what the graph is showing is that the trend is going up. In other words, the climate has been getting steadily warmer. And over this time period, it's getting warmer at about 42 degrees Fahrenheit per decade.
Well, does this 0.2 Fahrenheit per decade, does that tell a complete picture?
Well, a trend line is very influenced by what the starting point is. And so if you started the trend line at a different point along these measurements, you would get a different rate of warming. So, for example, in the Montana climate assessment, we started the trend line at 1950 to 2015, and that showed a 0.43 degree Fahrenheit warming per decade. If we had started it at 1970, it would be a 0.53 degrees Fahrenheit warming per decade. So the point is that it doesn't really matter where you put that starting point. There's been warming across this time series, this data set.
And in terms of what you've alluded to as the 1950 to 2015 time period, over that time period, how's Montana warmed?
Well, on average, it's warmed 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, taking the state as a whole, from 1950 to 2015.
And, Dr. Whitlock, is the rest of our nation warming?
Yes, so this Montana is not unique in this warming. This is really what's happening in the country and the world as a whole. It's interesting that Montana's warming at a little bit faster rate than the rest of the contiguous U.S. And the reason for that is that we're a high elevation state. We have a northern location, and the high latitudes are warming faster than anywhere else in the planet. And it's a high elevation state. It's got a northern latitude. Oh, and we're far from the ocean. So we don't have any kind of moderating effect on the climate.
Dr. Whitlock, can you describe this slide we're seeing here headed rising temperatures in the last century, continental U.S.?
Yeah, this comes from the Environmental Protection Agency showing how much temperatures have warmed over the last century. And the red shows you, the intensity of the red on the graph shows you how much warming has occurred. And you can see that why Montana is just a little bit warmer than sort of the national average because of its location.
Earlier in your testimony, you told us about Montana's topography and geography. How does that help us understand Montana's greater warmth?
Well, as I said before, it's because our high elevations tend to warm faster. And also we're a long ways from the ocean, so there's we don't have the moderating effect that the coastal states have. And we're in a northern location, and the high latitudes are warming faster than the rest of the country.
Because we're seeing data where temperatures go up and down, it might be helpful if you explain the difference between weather and climate.
Well, weather is what's happening in the atmosphere of the order of hours to days, months, weeks, up to years, I would guess. And it's the sorts of things that you get on your phone app when you look at the weather. It's the temperature, it's the precip, it's the humidity. I tell my students that weather determines what you reach in your closet and what you wear that day. That's weather. Climate, on the other hand, is the average of weather. So it's the long-term trends in weather data, and it's usually measured over 30-year periods by the climate science community. So if you think of the what you wear as being the weather, the climate is all the clothes in your closet.
So in essence, there's going to be annual variations in temperature. Is that correct?
There are.
And that's always been the case and always will be. Is that correct?
Yes.
But if you want to talk about climate, it's a trend you want to look at.
Yeah, it's the average over 30-year periods.
And for purposes of Montana, in your opinion, what are we seeing in terms of these long-term trends?
Montana is getting warmer. It's getting warmer, and the rate of warming is increasing.
Because we're going to be talking about temperatures, it might be helpful to explain how temperatures in Montana are measured. Can you do that, please?
Yeah, the dots on this map are the weather stations that were used for the Montana climate assessment. We used a network that included 114 stations around the state. And you can see they're pretty well, the coverage is pretty good across the state. Most of the stations are in very rural areas, some are in urban areas, but the coverage is pretty even. And what happens with these data is they're then used to infer the climate of the entire state, places where there aren't weather station data. And then those data are summarized by climate divisions. So NOAA has climate divisions for the whole country, and there are seven of these climate divisions in Montana, which I've shown here on the map, the northwestern, the central, northeastern, southeastern, south central, southwestern, and central. So some of the data in the Montana climate assessment is really just presented by these climate divisions. as a summary.
The slide we're displaying now is total change in average annual temperatures by region in Fahrenheit from 1950 to 2015. So, in your opinion, has every part of the state warmed?
Yeah, the color of orange and red shows you warming. Blue would be cooling, but the intensity of the red shows you how much warming is going on. So here on the vertical axis are those climate divisions, the set of climate divisions that I showed you, as well as the state average and the national average. And then vertically, we have on the left the annual temperature for all those regions, as well as the winter, spring, summer, and fall. And you can see that since 1950, between 1950 and 2015, there's been warming in almost every season, especially winter and spring, in almost every region or division.
Have there been any particular seasons that have experienced the most warming?
I think from the graph that we're showing, you can see that winter and spring have warmed the most. And the north central region and the northeastern region have warmed the most of all the divisions. But spring has warmed significantly as well. Summers have warmed, but less so. And fall, some regions have shown warming, but some have shown no change.
Dr. Whitlock, are your calculations based on, for purposes of this chart, are they based on actual historic measurements taken in Montana?
Yeah, these are the measurements that come originally from those 14 stations that I showed on the previous map. So they're direct observations.
And do you have any doubt about the validity of these measurements?
No, I do not.
In terms of the plaintiffs in this case, what's likely to be the effects going forward on the plaintiffs given these temperature issues?
The plaintiffs are experiencing and living with this warming trend, and this warming trend that started before they were born, but has been accelerating, and it's affecting all of them.
What does the future hold for temperatures in Montana?
The climate projections show that Montana is going to become warmer, still warmer at an even faster rate going into the future.
And does any of Montana's future warming, is that affected by projected greenhouse gas emissions?
Yes, it's directly a result of the increase in greenhouse gas emissions as a result of the burning of fossil fuels. So it's directly due to anthropogenic climate change.
We're going to be using the acronym on some of the graphs of RCP. Can you briefly give a description or an explanation of the term representative concentration pathways, or RCP?
I could give a whole lecture on this, so I'll try to keep it short. Representative concentration pathways are developed by the international climate community. And what they are is plausible scenarios of what CO2 concentration will be like in the future. And these representative concentration pathways are then used as the input for climate models. So they're used as different scenarios in climate models for looking at the future. RCP 8.5 is a high emission scenario, meaning there's a lot of CO2 in the atmosphere. RCP 4.5 is an intermediate emission scenario, and probably one that we might be on if all countries will meet their commitments to reduce greenhouse gases. In Montana, the climate model projections suggest warming under both of these scenarios, RCB 8.5 and RCP 4.5. But the warming is greater in the high emission scenario. That's about a 10 degree Fahrenheit warming by the end of the century. And 4.5 still has significant warming by the end of the century. We're about five to six degrees Fahrenheit warmer.
And what's displayed here is in Montana relative to 1971-2000. What does that mean?
Well, when you're giving increases, you always have to say what the baseline was that you're comparing it to. So these RCPs are using 1971 to 2000 baseline as the benchmark for comparison.
And what was warming like in Montana during that baseline period, 1971 to 2000?
Well, already we were experiencing warming during that period. We were, if you start with 1950, if you use a 1950 time period, we were warming at about 0.4 degrees Fahrenheit per decade.
So given that baseline, let's assume the youngest plaintiff in this case at 2100 will be 82. What will temperatures look like in either RCP 8.5 or RCP 4.5 for that plaintiff?
These are big temperature increases, whether you're looking at annual or looking at the different seasons. And so the plaintiffs by the end of the century are going to be experiencing much warmer conditions than now.
And are these projections based on the, these RCP projections based on the IPCC report?
Yes, they're developed at the international level and used in the IPCC, but they're also standard emission scenarios that are used in climate assessments and climate research around the world.
So I'd like to get a little bit more specific about increased temperatures. But first off, what does extreme heat mean?
Well, in the climate assessment, we looked at 90 degrees Fahrenheit and higher because, you know, that's when people really start to suffer from health conditions and it just generally hot weather for all of us, I would say.
And that's the 2017 climate assessment?
Yes, the Montana climate assessment, right?
And does Montana already experience extreme heat?
It does, yeah. We've seen many days over 90 degrees, and the numbers increased by days to weeks since 1950.
We earlier talked about temperature rise. As temperatures rise, will extreme heat rise?
Yes.
So could you explain, with reference to the slide we have here, generally what we're looking at?
Yeah, the top two maps in Montana, RCP 4.5 scenarios, and the bottom two are RCP 8.5 scenarios. So, and on the left are the mid-century projections, and on the right are the end-of-the-century projections. Again, the color intensity is telling you sort of how many more days we're going to get above 90 degrees. And you can see that that every part of the state gets significantly more days. It's 11 days in mid-century in the western part, but it's over a month in the eastern part of Montana. And generally, eastern and southeastern Montana are going to experience the most days over 90. By the end of the century, we're looking at a couple of months over 90.
Dr. Whitlock, I put a new slide up. It's headed monthly change in average temperature. Is this slide pulled off the slide you just testified about?
Yes, this comes from the Montana Climate Assessment as well. Again, the top panel is RCP 4.5 and the bottom is RCP 8.5, and both of these are mid-century. But the vertical axis are the climate divisions that I've talked about, And the horizontal axis is the months of the year from January to December. And so it's showing you how much warming is in a particular month in a particular climate division region. And what you can see is that every region warms. So warming is happening across the state, and it's the summer months in particular that are warming the most as we go into the future. I should say this is a very robust result from climate models, that they all show this warming across the state in the future.
So by robust, you mean all the models you and your team examined, it's essentially confirms
100% of the 20 models that we looked at, yeah, show this result.
Now let's look at the other side of the thermometer. What's extreme cold?
Extreme cold, this is a graph from NOAA. And extreme cold is temperatures of 0 degrees Fahrenheit or lower. If I may explain this graph, so this is the number of days of temperatures that are below zero, going from 1900 to 2020. The black line that's going up and down, those are the actual measurements per year, and the blue bars are five-year averages. And then horizontally, you can see what the average is if you take all those data and just average them from 1900 to 2020. I think what's interesting about this graph is that from 2000 on, we've had very few days, a real reduction in days where the maximum temperature is 0 degrees or lower. And that's directly a result of warming temperatures as a result of anthropogenic climate change.
And again, to be clear, are these the slide, what it displays, they're from actual measurements of stations in Montana, correct?
They are from actual measurements, yes.
Okay, we're going to get into another concept called freeze-free days. Can you explain what a freeze-free day is?
That's a tongue twister. Freeze-free days are days when the temperature doesn't get to 32 or lower. So there's no freezing. And these are projections in the future. This is RCP 4.5 at the top. The top two graphs and RCP 8.5. The bottom two graphs. On the left is the mid-century, and on the right is the end-of-century projections. And the story is really quite simple. There just aren't going to be very many days that get below freezing. In other words, the number of days above freezing is going to increase by weeks to months in the future.
And again, you're using the RCP 4.5 and 8.5 scenarios for purposes of this slide relative to 1971 and 2000 average.
That's correct.
I'm going to show you the locations of the plaintiffs on one of the earlier heat maps that you testified about. And this heat map is, again, RCP 8.5 for the time frame 2070 to 2099. How will the increases in temperature, in your opinion, harm these plaintiffs?
Well, you can look at this graph, and so this is the number of days over 90.
Quick. As long as it doesn't go to her, it's driving a health risk other than just climate. I mean, because she's not a medical doctor. That's my only issue. She can testify to what her opinion is to how the harm to them from the increase, but from an environmental standpoint and a weather standpoint, not a medical standpoint. That's my objection.
Well, I guess we'll see what she starts to say here.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You can see that the plaintiffs are going to experience all of them many more days above 90 degrees Fahrenheit at the end of the century. In the east side, Eva and Ricky are going to experience almost 2 months more of days over 90 degrees by the end of the century. But all of them are going to experience a month or more.
And what about winters? Will they be as cold for these plaintiffs?
No, there'll be much fewer days below freezing for all of them.
And will the plaintiffs notice the impacts on the ecosystems around them?
I would think that they would.
Now, for example, some of the plaintiffs, Lander and Badge, go hunting. What will it be like if someone in during this time frame wants to go out hunting?
Well, I know from my own research and others is that anytime the climate has changed, animals really face three choices. They can move.
Objection, foundation, or and speculation.
Well, I rely more, I think she said, from her own studies.
They go extinct and so their numbers decrease, or they adapt to climate. And so what we're seeing and we'll likely see is populations on the move and population numbers declining in response to climate change.
Can you describe some of the research you've done on this topic?
I've looked at this question over the last 20,000 years where there's been climate changes in the past, looking at how animals' ranges and plant ranges have changed in response to climate change, how fast those changes occur, and where they occur.
And other plaintiffs in this case engage in outdoor sports and activities during the summer and fall. How will those plaintiffs be impacted?
I imagine they're going to be facing many days where it's very, very hot, and this will, limit their abilities to be outdoors.
So some plaintiffs fish. What's going to happen there?
We've seen already that the temperatures in the streams have increased to the point where streams have been closed to fishing, and that certainly will be a trend for the future.
So in your opinion, do the greenhouse gas emissions occurring as a result of Montana's projects matter?
Yes.
Why do you say that?
Well, because every ton of CO2 put in the atmosphere contributes to global warming.
And in your opinion, is there any time frame or urgency needed to deal with this?
I think that's the challenge, is to reduce the amount of greenhouse gases that go into the atmosphere as quickly as possible.
Now, is that just your opinion, or do other climate scientists agree?
That's a broad opinion across the climate science community.
Let's shift from temperatures to precipitation. Have there been any changes in precipitation in Montana to match those changes in temperature?
Well, this is a graph of model precipitation. So the positive values above the zero line are places where you've gotten more precipitation, and the negative values are places where there's been less precipitation. And the model data go from 1950 to the end of the century. And one thing that we found and reported on in the climate assessment is that there really hasn't been any trend in precipitation in Montana historically. So from 1950 to 2015, precipitation has gone up and down, but there's not been any real long-term trend. In fact, then when you look at precipitation in climate models going into the future, there's actually an increase in precipitation, a slight increase in the future. And it shows up in both RCP 4.5 and RCP 8.5. And that's an annual precipitation. I want to be sure to make that point.
Sure. So you've noted there hasn't been much of an annual change. What about a seasonal change?
Yeah, these data come from the Greater Yellowstone Climate Assessment, and it's again showing places where the negative numbers of precipitations decreased and positive numbers it's increased. And what we're seeing is not so much the annual precipitation is showing a trend, but rather it's the season of precipitation that's changed. What you can see in this graph is that winters and summers since 1950 have gotten drier. There's been less precipitation, and there's been more precipitation in spring and fall.
So seasonal precipitation, that's the crux of the issue?
It is. That's the thing that's changing.
And in your opinion, will this trend or these trends continue?
Yes, they will continue, I believe.
Can you give us your opinion on the effects of precipitation on for purposes of climate change in the coming decades?
These two charts come from the Montana Climate Assessment. And again, the vertical axis is the climate divisions we've talked about, and the horizontal axis is the month of the year from January to December. The top graph is RCP 4.5. The lower graph is RCP 8.5. Blue shows you places where, blue-green is places where we're getting more precipitation, and the intensity of the color shows you where the precipitation is highest. And yellow is where we have those negative values in precipitation as well. So, and these are being compared from 1971 to 2000 average. What the graph shows is that precipitation is increasing in winter and spring in the future, as well as a little bit in the fall, but it's decreasing in the summer. So summers are getting drier, and spring, winters, and falls are getting wetter.
And what does this mean for the future of summers in Montana?
Well, as Dr. Running pointed out yesterday, summers are getting longer because it's getting warmer, and they're getting drier because there's just going to be less precipitation in summer.
And do these dry conditions result in the risk of drought?
Yeah, when you put warmer temperatures together with less precipitation, you not only get less moisture falling out of the sky, but you increase evaporation and you increase transpiration from plants. That's the water loss from plants. So all of that creates drought.
And do the wetter conditions in the fall and spring have an effect on snowpack?
Yeah, the depending on the season that we get precipitation determines whether we get snow or rain. So if you have a lot of precipitation in the spring, it's likely to come as rain. In the fall, it's likely to come as rain as well. So we're changing not only the timing, but the type of precipitation in the future.
So in your opinion, how will the combination of temperature and precipitation affect the future of Montana?
I guess just to kind of repeat over or give a summary of what I was saying, we're looking at rising temperature. We're looking at changes in the timing and the location of precipitation. And then we're looking at whether the kinds of changes we'll see is whether we get snow or whether we get rain.
And will that be, in your opinion, all over the state?
All over the state.
Now, how will these changes affect the plaintiffs?
Well, it's going to affect them in all kinds of ways. If you think about Ricky, for example, on her ranch, warmer temperatures, longer summers, drier summers, are going to affect their ability to ranch and their livelihoods. If you think about Eva, who we heard from, and Grace, they're worried about hot temperatures in the summertime and how they're going to deal with that. So it's going to affect affect them. And then you have plaintiffs that depend on snowpack for training to be skiers and for their livelihoods as ski instructors, and that will be impacted as we get less snow and more rain.
So you just referenced snowpack. What's happened to Montana's snowpack?
It's been decreasing. So these are trends in April snowpack. So as Dr. Running explained yesterday, April 1st is sort of it's the target date by which we compare snowpack from one year to the next or one station to the next, April 1st. And snowpack is measured as the amount of water in the snowpack. So it's not the snow depth or the kind of snow, but it's the amount of water, snow water equivalent, we call it sometimes. Okay, so this graph of Montana, the size of the circles tells you the amount of change that's happened at various snow measuring sites. So large circles are higher values than low circles. Red values are the stations that have shown a decline in snowpack. And you can see that almost all of Montana has shown a decline. Some stations almost get no snow at all, so it's a greater than 80% change. And this is going from 1955 to 2015. In general, there's been about a 25% loss in snowpack across Montana over this period.
The next slide is headed Montana, April 1 snow water equivalent, 1935 to 2015. Can you, and it says data from all elevations. Can you explain this slide?
Yeah, these data come from all the snow measuring sites. And as I said, it's April 1st snowpack or the April 1st snow water equivalent. The data go from 1935 to 2015. So it's high in all elevation sites. The gray line going up and down are the annual measurements, and then there's sort of a five-year moving average is the blue line through time. But just notice the solid black line, that's the trend. And what we can see is that even though we've had some years of snow and some years of low snow, the overall trend is towards declining snowpack. And that's true west of the Continental Divide and east of the Continental Divide.
And is it also true at what I'm going to call high and low elevations?
It is true at high elevations and low elevations. In fact, low elevations are losing snowpack at a slightly faster rate, just because they're right on the borderline between snow and rain at any given time.
Let's turn to a slide headed loss of snowpack. Upslope shift in elevation of rain. There's a lot on this slide, so please take your time to, can you explain what this slide depicts?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. This comes from the Greater Yellowstone Climate Assessment. So it's looking at snowpack and rain in that region. So let's start with the bottom graph. The vertical is elevation from 4,000 to 12,000 feet, and the horizontal, it goes from 1950 to 2100, so the end of the century. Now, blue colors are the elevation of snow on that graph. Green is the elevation of rain, and red, orange, and yellow is the elevation of rain to snow transition, or what I call slush. It's the kind of weather we all hate. What you can see is that in 1950, the snow elevation was about 7,000 feet. But simply because of warming temperatures since then and into the coming century, the elevation of snow is rising, such that by the end of the century, 2100, the elevation of snow is going to be about 9,500 to 10,000 feet. That's what that graph shows. Now, above that are the maps that go along with the graph. The black line is the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem. And the map on the left shows you the area of snow in 1990. So you can see the blue is quite extensive, and you can also see the other types of precipitation. The next map moving towards the right is 2030, 2050, 2070, and on the right is the end of the century. We're simply losing our snowpack, not because there's less precipitation, but because more of the precipitation is falling as rain, and that's because the temperatures are warmer, and they're warmer because of anthropogenic climate change.
So, in your opinion, how does this decline or loss of snowpack affect these plaintiffs?
It affects the plaintiffs in a number of ways. Plaintiffs that depend on reliable snow in the winter for, say, recreation, it's going to be less and less reliable, especially in the shoulder seasons in the spring and the fall, because there'll be more precipitation coming in the form of slush and rain. So it affects winter recreation. It also affects summer conditions because snowpack is those are our reservoirs of water through the summer. And when you lose that snowpack or you don't store it as long, then you go into summer being drier. So that means that communities and ranchers rely on water at the end of the summer in a way that you predict are going to be struggling.
So I want you to assume that Plaintiff Sarael is going to testify about how snow is a necessary component of certain traditional ceremonies like coyote stories, creation stories, and that her elders are only able to share these stories when there's snow on the ground, but that in 2020 and in recent winters, the snows melted too quickly and the oral history couldn't be shared with her or with her community. In your opinion, is what you've just testified about snowpack, is that going to affect her cultural and tribal heritage?
The standing narrative of rejection, and then I'll just sit down and lead you. Thank you.
Could try to have her testify more, but you can answer the question.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, this will impact her because she lives in a low elevation area, and those are the elevations that are losing their snowpack rapidly, and so snowpack will be much less reliable.
What about plaintiff Georgie, who's a competitive skier?
Yeah, Georgie needs snowpack for her training. She needs good quality snow, and so that's going to be challenged as well going into the future as we have more slush, less reliable snowpack.
And yesterday you were here for Plaintiff Ricky's testimony, such as reservoirs to water cattle in the summer. How will the decline in snowpack affect Ricky?
Ricky's reservoirs will continue to have a hard time filling because there'll be less snow, more rain, so there'll be less storage in those reservoirs, and that will be a burden in the summertime, especially.
Dr. Whitlock, you testified earlier about snowpack declining faster at lower elevations, but will the snowpack decline faster in certain parts of the state?
Yeah, there's the snowpack decline is greatest in the western part of the state. We get the most snowpack there, but it's the low elevations in particular. And so that's going to affect these plaintiffs that live west of the Continental Divide.
So plaintiffs Kian, Lander, Badge, Talia, Sariel, Micah, Grace, and Olivia, those are the areas that have experienced the largest declines?
Yes, and that trend will continue.
So do you have any predictions on what's going to happen to snowpack in Montana?
We're going to get less snowpack. We're going to get more slush, more, you know, really wet snow, and more rain going into the future.
Let's turn now to spring flooding. Can you give me an example of spring flooding?
Well, Eva yesterday talked about two floods. One is the floods on the Shields River in 2019, which wiped out our bridge. And then there were spring floods again in 2019, which wiped out the temporary bridge. This has been called the tsunami of 2018. It's not really a tsunami, but I think it got that name because of the sort of rapid rise of water that they experienced. And then she also mentioned the floods that we're now having the anniversary of today, the Yellowstone floods. And in fact, I should say most of our rivers have experienced kind of unprecedented flooding in the spring.
And in your opinion, will the number of spring flooding events increase in the future?
They will, because the snowpack, with rising temperatures, the snowpack melts faster and the water comes up off faster. And we also get these rain on snow events. So you already have a kind of a wet snowpack in the spring. And then you put warm rain on top of it. It melts really fast. The ground's already saturated. So the water has no choice but to roar down the hill slopes into the streams. Great flooding.
And are these floods consistent with anthropogenic climate change?
They are, because, again, warmer temperatures mean that we're getting less snowpack. The snowpack melts sooner.
Dr. Whitlock, I put a slide up headed Stream Flow Projections Clark Fork. Can you please explain this slide?
This comes from the Montana Climate Assessment, and it's a good example of how we think snow melt-dominated rivers will respond in the future with warming. So let me explain. The positive numbers on the vertical axis are where the runoff is going to increase, and the negative where the runoff or the stream flow will decrease. And that's based on looking at the 1970 to 2000 year average stream flow values. What we think and what model projections are showing is that we're going to see more runoff in winter and spring in these types of systems, and that the peak flow, the time when the flow is the highest, is going to be happening earlier and earlier. By the middle of the century, it'll be 15 to 25 days earlier in this model projection. Because we lose the snowpack and it comes off so fast, then we go into summer with less water and there's a decrease in stream flow.
And do you have a high degree of confidence that these stream flow projections are going to occur if we're in RCP 8.5?
I have no doubt, yeah.
Dr. Whitlock, we've covered flooding and stream flow. Let's shift and now spend time talking about what's a drought?
Well, drought has many definitions, actually. There's meteorological drought. So this is just when we don't get a lot of precipitation and it's very warm and there's a lot of evaporation. There's hydrological drought, which is measuring the water flow in streams and reservoirs and lakes. There's agricultural drought, which is looking more specifically at water availability and soil moisture. And then there's ecological drought, which is, you know, are the plants and animals getting enough water? And are there water deficits or water surpluses in the ecosystem?
Are droughts seasonal?
Droughts can be seasonal. They can be yearly. They can be decadal. Droughts have no specific timelines.
Will anthropogenic climate change have an effect on droughts in Montana?
Yes.
And generally, what will that effect be?
Well, again, it's a function of warming. We're melting the snowpack, which has a big influence on whether we go into drought in the summer. So there's less water available at the end of spring. Summers are longer because of the warmer. So that combination of warmer and drier is going to lead to more droughts.
And will drought conditions be more severe in Montana?
They will be more severe, I think, in the future.
I'm going to shift now to kind of a long slide that I hope you can explain. It's called Montana Percent Area and U.S. Drought Monitor Categories. Can you explain what's depicted on this slide?
Yeah, this is put up by the National Drought Monitor Group that works with NOAA, and it comes out every 2 weeks. So this is the most recent map. The data go from so the present day going back, and then they go back on the horizontal left to 2000. That's when they started doing these drought monitor measurements. And it's telling you on the vertical axis the percent of the state that's in drought. And they have different categories of drought. So the darkest color is what they call D4. It's exceptional drought. It's the kind of drought you might see once in a century, once or twice in a century. Then there's red, the D3, that's extreme drought. That's every 20 or 50 years. D2 is severe drought every 10 to 20 years. And then you have moderate drought, and yellow is the abnormally dry conditions, not technically drought, but the kinds of dry conditions we get every few years. Just to explain this graph, then you can see that there was a period, we had a major drought from 2000 to about 2006. And this actually has been named, it's called the turn of the century drought. And you can see that large sectors of the state were in exceptional drought and also extreme drought, but most of the state was in drought in one form or another. Then we went out of it around 2006, and we had some years in drought. And just more recently, the other end of the graph, 2021, we moved back into drought conditions with extreme droughts and all of the state covered in some level of drought. And now we're sort of moving out of that drought, at least in the last few iterations of this map, the last few months.
So in other words, you're saying we're moving out of it, and what does that mean?
I mean that if you look at the right-hand side of the graph, whereas in 2021, there was a lot of area covered by the red and orange and yellow colors. Now, as you go to the present day, those colors are dropping off.
So this slide depicts a time frame, 2022. Can you briefly explain how this compares to droughts in Montana's past?
Let me just note that it's 2000 to actually today, June 12th, 2023.
Yesterday,
yeah. So your question is, how do they compare to droughts in the past?
Yes.
These sort of multiple year droughts we have had in the past. We had a period of dry years in the Dust Bowl that lasted about a decade. There were dry years in the 50s, dry years in the late 1980s, early 1990s. So we have had some periods of prolonged drought.
But can you explain another concept, seasonal drought?
Yeah, and if I can follow up on the point that you just made, what's making these so interesting and kind of concerning is that we've had these two large droughts so close together. And that's different than the kinds of drought conditions that we've seen in the past where we have maybe a dry decade, but then we move into quite wet conditions.
So to restate what you just said, what we're seeing in the slide from 2000 to yesterday is different than what Montana's experienced in the past.
It's been, yeah, because we're part of this, it looks like we're part of this series of droughts in the 21st century.
And now, Tony, can you please explain what seasonal drought is?
Yeah, seasonal drought is when we go from wet conditions in one season to very dry, droughty conditions in another season. And a good example of that is 2017. You can see that little spike between 2017 and 2018 on the graph. 2017 was a pretty normal year. It was warm, but it was warm. And springs were warm and wet. And that was looking very, very promising. But then all of a sudden, the precipitation stopped. And we went from warm and wet to warm and dry. And we moved into drought in a matter of weeks. Climate scientists call that a flash drought, in the same way you might think of a flash flood, where you just quickly switch the weather situation.
And what were the impacts of the 2017 drought?
Well, we had a record fire year that year. 4.8 million acres burned in 2017. I think Ricky may have talked about that. And it started, the fire started in grassland in the eastern part of the state. And then we had the big fires around Sealy Lake and that area later on in the summer as a result of these droughts. And in terms of crop damage, for the Great Plains, Southern Great Plains, it was about $2.6 billion in crop damage as a result of this flash drought, this really rapid drought that came in what otherwise seemed like it would be a normal year.
In your expert opinion, do you view these seasonal droughts as more likely to occur in the future?
I think so, because what we're seeing more and more is this really rapid transition of the seasons. And from my own personal experience, I look at this last year where we had a lovely fall, and then suddenly we were in winter. It just flipped. And then we had a very prolonged winter in Montana, and it suddenly flipped into spring and then now into summer. We're seeing this transition of the seasons being very abrupt. And so I think the conditions for flash drought are happening.
And in your opinion, does anthropogenic climate change play a role in that?
I think, yeah, the severity of drought, when and where it occurs, is influenced strongly by anthropogenic warming.
And will anthropogenic warming have an effect on groundwater?
Groundwater, the relation between groundwater and climate really depends on where you are in the state and what the geology is like. And so in the western part of the state, there's a very close and rapid connection between how much groundwater there is and how much precipitation. In other words, the precipitation cycles through the groundwater system really quickly. Whereas in other parts of the state, in eastern Montana, the groundwater has a longer residence time, but it too is showing sort of climate trends and responding to decadal trends in climate.
What effect do these drought conditions have on the plaintiffs?
Well, this is the latest map from the U.S. Drought Monitor Group. So it's interesting.
Excuse me, as of June 6, 20.
As of June 6, yeah, I believe it's the most recent map. And it's showing you parts of the state are in severe drought and moderate drought, and parts of the state are dry as well. So this is the tail end of that drought we were looking at on the time graph. This last winter, we had high snowpack in southern, a lot of southwestern Montana, but northwestern Montana didn't get as much precipitation, and it's already in drought. Drought is already developing there, and it's you can follow this drought up into Canada, into Alberta, where we've had enormous fires already. The plaintiffs, three of the plaintiffs are highly susceptible to these conditions because they're already living in dry areas. So Kian, as I understand it, has a stream flowing through his property. It's a snow-fed, snow-melt stream, so it's going to be very sensitive to this low snowpack year. Claire, her family has water rights on a small stream, and as she goes through the summer, that's going to be an issue that the family has to deal with, who has the water rights and how much water is available. And then Ricky, who we heard from yesterday, is living in a drought area, and that's going to affect her agricultural activities in that community.
And will it also affect their future access to water?
It will affect their access to water, certainly as long as these conditions are developing. And I suspect that we'll get more severe as the summer goes on.
Two of the plaintiffs, Lander and Badge, enjoy hunting. What will drought conditions have in terms of wildlife?
Well, it's hard to say, but it will have an, it will affect the movement of these animals and possibly their numbers as they move around the landscape, looking for suitable places to live. Drought is definitely a big stressor on wildlife and also, of course, fish.
So I'd like to shift now to the effects of warming and a warming climate on ecosystems and fires. Has there been an increased fire activity in Montana?
Yeah, Dr. Running yesterday talked about the length of the fire season and how it was getting 2 months longer in recent history. This map shows you the climate of fires. So this is fire weather days. This is the number of days when the conditions are suitable. These are the hot, dry, windy days that all you need is an ignition source to get a fire. And this is showing you the number of those days from 1973 to 2022. So the intensity of the red color shows you which places have the most, has had the most increase in fire weather days. Of course, we know the Southwest and California has had a lot of these, but also look at Montana. The entire state has seen a significant increase in the number of days where we could get large and intense fires.
In terms of the plaintiffs in this case, what types of threats do the increased risk and severity of wildfires have on the plaintiffs?
Several of the plaintiffs have experienced wildfire, which must be a really scary experience for them. Some of them had to evacuate their homes or get ready to evacuate their homes. Some of them have seen their lands burn up and the erosion that follows. These guys are living with wildfire.
So yesterday we heard Ricky's testimony about wildfires. Why is Ricky increasingly experiencing this?
She's experiencing it because we're having more of these extreme weather days. And the reason we're having those is because we've been in these really long, dry summer conditions. And so really, as I said, all you need is an ignition when it's lightning or human set fires. And you get a large fire, difficult to control fire.
And does anthropogenic climate change play a role in this?
Well, it does in creating the fire weather conditions.
Why are so many of the youth plaintiffs experiencing wildfires in your opinion?
Well, they all live in fire-prone ecosystems. So these are ecosystems that have, through the long period, regularly burned. But now, because of climate change, the likelihood of fires has increased greatly.
What about the effects of wildfires on national parks? Can you describe that?
Well, national parks have burned like the rest of Montana. And one of the things that was brought up by a couple of the plaintiffs is the poor visibility from wildfire smoke. So this isn't just fires that are happening in Montana. They're happening across the West, bringing wildfire smoke into the region. And it's making it difficult to see our national treasures on any particular day in the summer.
Can you speak to the projections for wildfires in terms of increases in area burned and fire severity?
These data come from the Forest Service. They have a classification for fire conditions. Excuse me. An extreme fire danger are these fires that start quickly and they burn intensively and they spread rapidly and they often become very large. So it's a classification. And they've looked at historical data as well as climate projections for the future and what that would do to fire, extreme fire danger. So the top map on the left is showing you the number of days that we have these kinds of extreme fire danger conditions. And for the most part, it's kind of in the area of a week or a little bit more than a week from 1971 to 2000. The bottom is the climate projection for 8.5, RCP 8.5 for the middle of the century. And you can see that the number of days vastly increases to weeks. And that increases greatest in northwestern Montana, where the snowpack is declining significantly. And then the blue map is just the difference between the top graph and the bottom graph on the left, showing you the most impacted regions with the intensity of blue.
You earlier alluded to wildfire smoke. Do you have any opinions on essentially what's occurring in terms of wildfire smoke?
The wildfire smoke is something that we're all going to have to live with, unfortunately, as we go into the future. This is a set of maps that look at smoke wave intensity. So a smoke wave is when you get more than 2 days of smoke, and the intensity is the particle size that's in that smoke. And so here's 2004, 2009. We were getting smoke, but it was in fairly low levels across the West. And the amount of smoke in the smoke waves was not particularly high. That's the map on the left. And on the right is a projection for mid-century, and it shows that we're going to get a lot more smoke, not a lot more smoke, but there'll be more content to the smoke, more particles in the smoke, and probably more consecutive days of smoke going into the future. And Montana just stands out here as one of the highest areas of smoke wave intensity because we're getting smoke from fires all over the West, as well as in Montana.
And I forgot to ask you, can you explain what you mean by the term, or what is meant by the term smoke wave intensity?
Yeah, as I said, a smoke wave is when you have two consecutive days of smoke with particulate matter above 2.5 micron particles. And the smoke wave intensity is that you're actually getting more particles than that cutoff in the smoke.
What aspects of a plaintiff's livelihoods will, in your opinion, be affected by climate change?
This is a slide that I developed by talking to communities around Montana.
Actually, since Black's Mountain evidence, we have no idea what they're going to be as far as occupations they're concerned. So this is about their livelihoods. And it calls for speculation and foundation.
I'll let you proceed to see if you can tie it into the findings.
Thank you, Your Honor.
It's not really about livelihoods. It's about people's concerns. So these are conversations that I've had with Montanans in different communities as I present some of the information in the Montana Climate Assessment. Universally, people are worried about water availability and water storage and what's going to look like in the future. People are worried about floods. Some of them have already experienced floods, spring floods, and summer drought. People that are hunters and fishers that I've talked to are worried about how that's going to be, how hunting is going to be affected.
There was a question about livelihood, and then she changed the topic. Was not responsive to the question.
Can you rephrase the question, please?
Certainly. Based on, you've gone around the state presenting the 2017 Montana Climate Assessment, correct?
Yes.
And in terms of people informing you what their concerns were during the course of your presenting the Montana Climate Assessment, for purposes of providing you notice as to what were the concerns, what were they telling you?
Objections, relevance, and what the people were telling her.
This sounds like overruled.
People have talked to me about their concerns about livestock and crop decisions, about wildfires, about what it means for their community and their long-term community resilience, and then about human health.
The harms you just described, are these the types of harms that should be analyzed in an environmental analysis under BEPA in your opinion?
So yes, it should be considered.
Do you, Dr. Whitlock, have an opinion on the effects of climate change on agriculture in Montana?
The Montana Climate Assessment had a chapter on agriculture that we developed, and it was written. Many of the co-authors were farmers and ranchers themselves. And what interested me was the sort of decision space that farmers and ranchers operate under when it comes to climate change.
How does, based on your understanding, climate instability impact farmers and ranchers in Montana?
Yeah, there's a lot of decisions that farmers and ranchers face, from global prices to local prices to government policies to insurance to how much pesticides to employ or herbicides and what they expect for the price of their crops and their livestock as a result of all those decisions. And what we discovered what we realized in the assessment was that climate change actually impacts all of those decisions. So climate change just isn't an independent forcer, but it's influencing all these decisions. And that creates a great deal of uncertainty for people in agriculture.
Yesterday you were here for Plaintiff Rickey's testimony about livestock. Was that an example of what you're talking about?
Yes.
We have a graph here on these factors. Can you briefly explain what this graph is?
Yeah, this comes from the Montana Climate Assessment, and I hope it explains the point that I made about the sorts of decisions that a farmer or rancher has to make in conducting their business. There's government policies, there's the global price of their commodity, there's the local price, there's insurance, there's the sorts of product inputs they put and what they're thinking about with pests. And that climate change doesn't just influence or interfere or interact with any one place in your decision making process, but really interacts with all of those levels.
In your expert opinion, will the impacts of climate change in Montana lessen, stay the same, or worsen in the future?
I think there'll be positives and negatives. So on the positive side, our growing season's gotten longer, and it's going to get longer still. And maybe a person like me can finally grow roses. It's getting warmer. We also can grow new crops. We have cantaloupes that are grown in northwestern Montana now that never could grow there before, and they're delicious. So those are positives, but the negatives, I think, outweigh the positives in many ways, because there's just so much climate variability now, so many extreme climate events, climate-driven weather events. The prospects of drought are increasing, which makes water availability much less certain at the end of the summer.
So will emissions in Montana today impact today's children in Montana as well as future generations?
Yes.
And in your opinion, is Montana already experiencing these harms?
They are. It is. Yeah.
And will the harms get worse?
The harms will get worse.
Now, will the climate instability get worse if Montana continues to emit greenhouse gases as it does now?
It will get worse as Montana continues to emit greenhouse gases.
Why is that?
Because, as I said earlier, every ton of CO2 that's released to the atmosphere impacts the climate. And so Montana has a role to play, like everywhere else on the planet.
And does that also apply to the fossil fuels that are in the ground that are taken out due to projects permitted by the defendants?
Yeah, Montana's carbon responsibility is, in my view, is not just what's consumed in Montana, but what's extracted, what's refined, what's transported.
What about the current situation in Montana, where a statute precludes the reviews of greenhouse gas emissions on climate change? In your opinion, from a scientific perspective, how do you view that statute?
My opinion, it's a big step backward. You know, climate change is the ultimate crisis that we're all facing, and so that constraint really is the wrong direction.
And have scientists like you and Dr. Running been warning about these climate dangers to officials with the state?
Yeah, Dr. Running and I have been talking about climate change for decades.
Can Montana continue its past and current fossil fuel policies and practices without harming these youth plaintiffs?
Objection irrelevant, both beyond and into the department that's been declared to move.
I'm sorry, what you were getting was.
Certainly, Your Honor. Can Montana continue its past and current fossil fuel policies and practices without harming these youth plaintiffs?
Well, that is broader than what we're. Can you tailor it more to me? I think you've already asked about that.
Sure. Yes, Your Honor. I'll move on. What about the urgency of considering fossil fuel impacts? Is there any urgency there?
Oh, there's real urgency, given the and that's the opinion at an international level, at a national level, and at the state level, that we, the climate science is clear that there's an urgent problem.
And in your opinion, to take steps to solve the problem, what should be done here in Montana?
We need to reduce as quickly as possible our reliance on fossil fuels.
And what about the utilization and development of fossil fuels? In your opinion, what should happen there?
Well, by reliance, I'm referring to not only what we consume, but what we produce and what we transport.
From a climate science perspective, is there any other way to protect Montana's clean and healthful environment and these youth plaintiffs and future generations?
No, I don't believe so.
Now, what effect do the state of Montana's actions have on the ability to stop or alleviate climate change?
Objection, speculation, combination, debate.
Could you repeat the question?
What effect do the state of Montana's actions have on the ability to stop or alleviate climate change?
Yeah, Montana's promotion of fossil fuel production is making the problem worse, because every ton of CO2 makes a difference.
And Dr. Whitlock, I just want to... thinking back yesterday about Dr. Running's testimony, I want to ask you a couple questions about why CO2 parts per million numbers vary. Is there a difference between the global annual average CO2 level and the seasonal average CO2 level?
Yes.
And is the global annual average CO2 level approximately 420 parts per million currently?
Yes, I believe so, yeah.
And is the monthly CO2 level currently about 424 parts per million?
Yes.
I'd like to turn now to a couple brief areas of rebuttal testimony you have concerning Dr. Curry, because again, Your Honor, Dr. Whitlock's going to be in Mongolia, and I offered to defendants that would take a very short period of time, and if Dr. Curry doesn't testify about these areas, we'd agree to strike them from the record.
All
right. Thank you.
Was Dr. Curry's work in terms of her data sources and her opinions on variability by years change your opinion on Montana's temperatures? And here, Your Honor, I'm referring to pages 3 and through 5 and 10 through 11 of Dr. Curry's report.
No, not really. This is the temperature graph we were looking at before, from 1900 to 2022, that's produced by NOAA, and Dr. Curry uses this graph as well. The blue line is the temperature trend that we've been talking about, 0.4 degrees Fahrenheit warming per decade. So that's the direction the climate is going. Dr. Curry, to mind you, cherry-picks some of the data because she notes, for example, that 1934 is the warmest year on record. Well, in fact, it's the co-warmest year on record. 1934 and 2015 are the warmest years on record. You can sort of cherry-pick the warmest and coldest years, but you're not talking about the trend. And if you look at these data, it's really striking that almost every year since 1985 has been above average warming. And that's what's significant.
Now let's turn to precipitation and drought. Can you explain to the court how Dr. Curry's opinion aligns with your opinion? And here, Your Honor, I'm referencing Dr. Curry's report at pages 5 through 7.
In the same way that Dr. Curry picks out warm years and cold years, she also focuses on the precipitation of the last, I believe it's 6 years, maybe 6 or 7 years of precipitation in Montana. And she only looks at the, she's only talking about the annual precipitation, and she notes that it's been about average, or in some places above average. But that is not the trend in the data. 6 years is not a long enough period of time to talk about trends in precipitation. The other thing that concerned me in her testimony was that she talks about annual precipitation when the real changes we're seeing are in seasonal precipitation. So to my view, that's like evaluating health based on the total number of calories that you take in a year, and not ask, are those calories coming from sugar or are they coming from protein? It matters when you take in calories. It matters what kind of calories you take. And just in the same way in precipitation, it matters when the precipitation occurs and whether it occurs as rain or snow. So in this graph, just one we've looked at already, annual precipitation hasn't changed significantly, but the seasonal precipitation has, and we're getting less precipitation in the winter and summer and more in spring and fall.
So what is your opinion about Dr. Curry's statements on the difference between rain and snow? And here I'm talking about of Dr. Curry's report at pages 7 and 8.
She doesn't make much differentiation between rain and snow because she really doesn't look at seasonal precipitation per se. She just talks about annual trends.
So in terms of snowpack, just to reiterate, are the trends increasing or decreasing?
Dr. Curry admits that especially in this century, the snowpack has declined. And we both refer to this graph from the Northern Rockies, looking at the April 1st snow water equivalent or the April 1st snowpack. This is from tree ring data, and it goes from 2000 to 1100. So it's about 900 years of climate data. Positive values, there's high snowpack. The negative values, there's low snowpack. And you can see the individual measurements from the tree ring record. And then you can see the blue line is the smooth data to show you more clearly the trends. Since the middle of the 20th century, we've seen decline of snowpack, and that snowpack has increased significantly in the 21st century. And that's what this data shows. We had low snowpack in the early part of the 20th century, but it's been surpassed now.
So I'd like to briefly discuss some concluding points. But before I get to this slide, I'd like to ask you, should the climate change harms in Montana that you've been testifying about today be included in any environmental analysis the state does in deciding to permit fossil fuel activity?
Yes.
And is it possible to consider Montana's climate impacts and how each ton of fossil fuel contributes to these harms in deciding to permit fossil fuel activity?
No, I'm not a carbon.
I'm going to object in the think this is the moot area.
Start over.
Certainly, Your Honor. Is it possible to consider Montana's climate impacts and how each ton of fossil fuel contributes to those harms in deciding to permit fossil fuel activity?
End objection.
Yes.
So, Dr. Whitlock, we have as a slide here the conclusion to the expert report of you and Dr. Running and Kenya. In parsing in your own words, however you want to do it, briefly conclude in summarizing your opinions that you've offered today.
Yes, I'll try to paraphrase this paragraph that we ended our expert report on. Montana's actions to promote the utilization and development of fossil fuels are inconsistent with the need to reduce emissions to stabilize the climate system. These ongoing actions penalize our children and future generations, including the 16 youth plaintiffs. And they will be penalized for as far into the future as we can imagine. The only solution is swift decarbonization of our energy system and immediate efforts to protect our hydrosphere and our biosphere. Dr. Running and I have been warning of the dangers posed by climate change and fossil fuels for decades. And yet Montana continues to aggressively pursue an expansion of fossil fuel utilization and production. There's little time remaining to avoid locking us into irreversible climate impacts. And we believe judicial intervention is essential to protect these children, as well as their environment and their natural resources. These are things they depend on for their well-being and their very survival.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Your Honor.
Dr. Whitlock, my name is Thane Johnson, and I represent the state of Montana and the defendants herein. Do you agree that the greenhouse gas energy from the energy division in Montana have gone down since 2005 to 2020.
I'm not a carbon policy person, so I can't speak to the levels of production or consumption. Mr. Peter Erickson is going to be talking about that later, but I can tell you that I know they fluctuated, and they've been impacted by things like COVID and energy decisions, yeah.
But you also introduced through you the 2020 Climate Solutions Plan, is that correct?
I was an author of that plan.
And you would agree with me that in the 2020 Climate Solutions Plan, it indicates that energy emissions from the energy side of Montana have declined by 21%.
Yeah, again, there'll be other experts talking about that. I really look at the climate impacts
of
CO2 emissions.
So you can't testify to the document that you helped co-author that's submitted as an exhibit?
I can testify to the parts that I was responsible for.
How about the parts that you weren't responsible for? As you sit here today, do you have any evidence to disagree with them?
No.
Thank you. I got to tell you, I love me some egg. Would you agree with me, Dr. Whitlock, that the second biggest contributor to greenhouse gases in Montana is the egg industry?
I actually think it's transportation. You have electricity, and then transportation, and then ag comes after that.
So third?
I would say.
Okay. And I agree with you. That's tough times for farmers to make these decisions, especially if they want to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Isn't that correct?
I would say yes.
Have you researched whether there is available for purchase an EV tractor, an electric tractor?
No, I haven't.
Okay. So you have no information regarding that?
No.
And you would agree with me that you would want, or Montana would need, all areas to contribute to reducing greenhouse gas emissions, correct?
Yes.
And that's a struggle if you can't purchase an electric tractor.
I would think so.
Also, do you have any knowledge concerning the availability of hydrogen tractors?
No, I have no knowledge of that.
Okay. And then the problem of charging that EV tractor out on a Montana farm or ranch would be very problematic as well, wouldn't it?
Well, I can't really speak to that. It's not my expertise.
I understand that, but one of your expertises was the decision-making involved in the ag industry and what they're doing. Is that correct?
Yes.
And that would have to be a part of that decision-making if the ag industry is going to decrease their contribution to greenhouse gas emissions. Wouldn't you agree?
I should think so.
And yet we have no knowledge of whether there's even an EV tractor available for purchase, correct?
I can't speak to that. I'm sorry.
And the methodology for charging that in the ag industry, correct?
It's something I could almost speculate on.
Okay. And you would agree with me that greenhouse gas emissions is a national problem?
It's a global problem, a national problem, and a local problem.
In fact, you said in a recent article in the Bozeman Chronicle, it's a local problem, a national problem, and an international problem. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
And you would agree with me that all areas have to do their part if we're going to reach that 2050 goal.
Yes.
That includes counties in Delaware, correct?
Yes.
That includes counties in Maryland, correct?
Yes.
That includes counties in Nevada, correct?
Yes.
And in countries all across the world, correct?
Yes.
And you would agree with me that, strike that. Now, you also put in that article that Bozeman Chronicle, and if you need to see it, I can show it to you, that Montana would have ranked 75th if it were a country in CO2 emissions on a per capita basis. Is that correct?
I believe so, yeah.
Where did you, what were you using for that stat as far as attributing Montana to CO2 emissions?
Well, the CO2 emissions for Montana are published in Department of Energy documents and Institute of Energy assessments, I think they're called.
So can you tell me what that number you were attributing to Montana was when you made that statement?
I was just looking at to what's consumed in Montana.
Okay, were you looking at Mr. Erickson's data, or what were you looking at?
I was using Mr. Erickson's data.
Okay.
And I was using the data that is published by the Department of Energy.
Would that be 6 million tons of CO2 annually?
No, it's 30 million tons in that ballpark.
Okay, 30 million tons annually of CO2 per metric ton, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's also, those data are also published per capita. So that was really, I wasn't doing the math myself. I was going to the per capita.
No, and I appreciate it. I just wanted to get the number. And so you're the number you were using to make that comparison was 30 million metric tons annually for Montana.
Yeah, as I said, I was looking at data sets that were reporting it as per capita.
That's fine, but that was the amount you attributed.
That's the starting point for that.
Okay, but that was the amount you attributed to Montana. Let's just clarify it, okay? It was 30 million metric tons per year.
I believe so, yeah.
Okay, thank you. And you stated in that article that would be 6 per capita for CO2 emissions for all of the states in the United States. Is that correct?
That's what was reported, yeah.
Okay. Would you agree with me that it also would be helpful to equate it to the territory of Montana versus the territory of the world? Because Montana is a big state, isn't it?
It's a big, low population state.
Yes. And as a result, it means that Montanans have to travel large distances, correct?
Well, sure.
And I don't know if last time you've been to Jordan, Montana, I don't know if there's very many EV charging stations. Would you agree?
I haven't been to Jordan in a while, so okay. I can't answer.
Would you expect there to be charging stations in Jordan, Montana, and along that 75 mile corridor where there's nothing?
I really couldn't speculate on that.
Okay, have you been to the High Line?
Yes.
Did you see any charging stations along the High Line on Highway 2?
I honestly haven't been there for a few years, and I just wasn't looking for that.
Okay. But that should be a part of the comparison is the size of Montana, correct?
Yeah, and the population, I think, is the critical thing.
Well, also the size, because it changes what Montana is all about, doesn't it?
Yeah, Montana's a large state.
Correct. And because agriculture is either the second or the third largest industry, it means as we stand here right now, we're kind of stuck to what we got, right?
Yeah. Yes.
And so do you know how big Montana is?
I don't. Do you? Sorry.
I can give you the number. Yes, I do. And I think the court can take judicial notice. I think the population of Montana versus the world population and the total habitable land of the world versus the state of Montana's acreage.
Excuse me, Ron. I'm just seeing this piece of paper for the first time, and I don't know where it came from.
I can show you where it came from. Comes from the census.
Well, Your Honor, I'm being handed a folder of a whole bunch of charts and numbers told it's in here. None of this was produced in discovery. So I don't understand what the precise figure of the population of Montana has to do with this witness's testimony on direct.
Your Honor, she, if I can respond.
Okay.
She provided in her article dated June 7th or 6th of this year, making relative comparisons to the CO2 emissions of the state of Montana versus other states versus other countries. So I think it's very relevant.
Well, Your Honor, she testified that she got all that data from the expert report of Mr. Peter Erickson. We'll stipulate to the admission of Mr. Erickson's expert report, and counsel can examine Dr. Whitlock about that, but that's not, but her testimony is that's where she got that information. And the article counsel's referring to, he brought up in cross, was not anything this witness brought up during the course of direct.
You can take judicial notice of facts that can be ascertained, readily ascertained, and I would ask that the court be able to take judicial notice of population of the of Montana versus the world and land area.
Johnson, it says the world population equals 7,979,010. I think you mean billions. So right there, I've got a little bit of a I mean, this is someone typed this up. I'm not actually trying to play the crowd. I'm just telling you, I don't know if this is accurate. I cannot take judicial notice of something that's been typed up, but I can't check this. It has to be something I can verify. So,
I will give you that if you don't mind, Your Honor.
Excuse me?
I can give that to you. I think it's in the census. Well, I will provide you a document that you can take judicial notice of, if that's fair, of the population, so that we can definitely take judicial notice of the census of Montana as 2020 and the world population as of the same date. I will get you that document. That's what I rely upon staff for, and I apologize if there's a typo. I will get that to you. Yesterday, Dr. Running testified that in accounting for fossil fuels, he did not include transporting fossil fuels alone through Montana. And you were here for that testimony, is that correct?
I was here, yes.
Do you disagree with Dr. Running?
No.
Okay. So it's kind of problematic as to what you give Montana credit for as far as fossil fuels going through the state, is that correct?
Objection. Your Honor, that's argumentative with the witness. I don't know what problematic means.
Well, I if you could ask her a question,
sure.
I'm not sure I'm understanding your point. Go ahead.
It's difficult to attribute to every Montanan fossil fuels that are just being transported across their highways, isn't it?
Yeah, again, I'm not a carbon policy person. We have Mr. Erickson's going to be speaking later in the week, so these sorts of questions are getting out of my area of expertise.
I understand, but you testified that you thought that Montana should be responsible for what was being transported through it and refined in it.
I think my point is that Montana is responsible or contributes to greenhouse gases in all those areas.
Okay, and so in attributing to Montana its CO2 emissions, you want to put with it what is being transported through the state.
Yeah, I'm not giving you a number. I think that there's experts that can talk about that, but I think in my own view that Montana contributes to the greenhouse gas problem in a number of ways, including what we consume, but also what we produce and what we transport.
And that includes what is transported from, say, North Dakota to the Pacific coast.
Yeah, I think in refined here as well. Energy that's refined here. But again, I would like to say that this is not my area of expertise.
I understand that, but you did testify to it, and I want to make it very clear.
Okay.
So it is your testimony that Montana is responsible for, this is my hypothetical, for the fossil fuel that is transported from North Dakota through Montana to the Pacific coast. That's the question.
Yes. It's Montana's contribution to greenhouse gas can be measured in all these different ways.
Okay, thank you. So it is your testimony that Montanans are responsible for that.
I said it's our contribution, yes.
Okay. Now, you would agree with me that we're taking 2023, the drought monitor. I saw that, and it showed the state. Frankly, 2023 has been a pretty good year for moisture.
It has been, although I think it's changing, but yeah.
And you also testified, I mean, I get the northwest corner is got some signs of drought, but that's dependent upon prevailing winds from the west, correct? Their moisture comes from prevailing winds from the west.
Yeah, they had less snowpack this year because the Pacific storms were not delivering snowpack to that part of the state.
And where did you come up with that data?
It's just available as on NOAA.
Okay. Would it surprise you? I was skiing on the last day, cross-country skiing on the last day of April at Essex and wrapping the same day.
Skiing and wrapping, great.
And were you here for Ms. Held's testimony?
Yes.
Okay. So you heard her testify that they no longer raise cattle. They just simply are their landlords now, correct?
Yes, I heard that.
Okay. So does that impact your testimony as far as the impact upon their ranching operations?
My understanding is that I'm testifying to the plaintiff's statements in that complaint.
Okay, but you testified that concerning the injury suffered by Ms. Held's family ranch, correct?
Yes, as it's stated in the complaint.
Okay, she's no longer, the Helds are now landlords. You heard that testimony, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so they're not, so the climate change you testified to does not impact their ranching operations as long as they continue to be landlords, correct?
Well, you'll have to talk to them. I don't actually know what their particular situation is and how involved they still are in a ranch. It's really not my area.
Okay, but you were here for her testimony.
I was here.
Okay, thank you. You would also agree that agricultural production in Montana has improved since 1997 to the present.
Yes.
Thank you. And I think it's interesting, the NOAA chart that you showed with regard to snowpack is indicative of what the snowpack is on April 1 of each year, correct?
Yes.
So, but it's not indicative of the actual snow that was received by Montana, correct?
No, that's not how it's measured, because that would be very inaccurate and very misleading, that way of considering snow.
But my point is, you would agree with me that if Montana received snow in March or February, that would not be reflected on the NOAA snowpack chart that was referenced in your testimony.
The snowpack is measured April 1st, so that's a record of what gets accumulated over the year and what melts over the year, but it's that particular date, because you need a date to compare places and time period year to year.
So the answer to my question is yes, that's not indicative, it's because it shows what's there on April 1.
Could you say not indicative of what again, please?
Okay. I'll rephrase it real carefully.
Thank you.
And that's why would you agree that the NOAA chart that you testified about is not indicative of what snow was received at a particular station in Montana, is it?
I wouldn't agree with that.
Okay, then you don't agree.
I think it's more complicated than you've asked.
Okay, so the answer is you disagree.
All right.
Okay. So an area could get snow in November and December and melt earlier and not be there on April 1. Fair?
Yes.
Okay. So it does not relate to the amount of snow a particular area received during the winter months, does it?
Not. It does and it doesn't. So how do I answer that for you?
Okay.
Is that good enough?
That's good enough.
Okay.
That's the beauty of a would you agree question. It's either yes, no, or I don't know.
Yeah.
And there is no, I didn't see any precipitation data for, or at least for snow for the last 5 years. Is that true?
I have to think, maybe not. We presented it for, perhaps the council could advise me. I think that the Montana climate assessment was close to 2015.
Okay. As far as I saw, I didn't see anything for the last 5 years.
Uh-huh.
Is that fair?
It's quite possible, yes.
Okay. And you testified about...
Council, I'd refer you to the slide, change in Montana annual precipitation, 1950 to 2100.
Well, that's a projection. That's not actual.
Change.
Well, I'm not in 2100 yet.
1950 to 2100.
But I'm not in 2100 yet. This was actual. That was my question.
Saying is the data is from 1950 to 2100. And if we had Dr. Whitlock and Dr. Running's report in there, she could refer to
that. So, Mr. Gregory, you can try to clarify that on redirect if you want.
Thank you, Dr.
And you testified that you comparing RPC 8.5 with RPC 4.5. What does RPC mean?
It's RCP.
Okay, thank you.
It's Representative Concentration Pathways. So that's used by the international community to look at future projections of climate change. Those are plausible scenarios of how much CO2 will be in the atmosphere at any point in time in the future.
Is that used by the ICP, the International Climate?
It's used, it's those RCPs are established by the International Panel on Climate Change, IPCC.
Thank you, the IPCC.
Mm-hmm.
And what is SSP?
SSP, yes. SSP means shared socioeconomic pathways. And so the most recent IPCC report, AR6, that came out over the last couple of years, and most recently a month ago was the last report, they use RCPs plus SSPs, which are even more sophisticated models to develop plausible scenarios in the future.
Okay, and they have SSP 5 through 8.5. Does that relate to the RCPs or the RPCs?
Objection, I can't see, Your Honor, what the council's displaying to the witness.
I can't really see it either.
Well, I'll bring it up.
Do we have a source of this document?
It comes from your expert reports.
Which expert report?
I think Mr. Erickson, but I couldn't say for sure. I got you from yours.
Well, Your Honor, I don't have Mr. Erickson's expert report here, and it's not in evidence, so I don't know how counsel can
show me. I'll withdraw that.
All right.
You would agree with me that the IPCC uses the RP, is it RPC or RCP?
RCP.
I'm going to write that down, okay? There's a lot of C's and P's involved in this. To make their projections, correct?
Yes.
And you would agree with me that the 8.5 RCP is the extreme?
It's now considered the extreme, yeah.
And in fact, the ICPP uses the middle one, 4.5, that you used as your other example, correct?
Yeah, and I mean...
Is that a yes?
Yes.
Thank you. Now my question to you is, if Montana just stopped emitting CO2s today. Mm-hmm. Every farmer threw in their keys to their tractors. I even handed you my keys. And we stopped as of this point today. Would you agree that that would not have an impact on global GHC or GHGs?
Every ton that Montana emits affects the climate.
I understand. I said we're not emitting anything. We're done. We've turned in our keys. We've turned in our tractors. There are no more emissions except for what's coming from National.
That would be a good step forward in trying to bring the climate system into equilibrium and stability.
So my question is, back to, would you agree? Would you agree if that occurred, that would not have any impact on the on global warming?
No, I don't agree with that.
Okay, that's fair. Would you agree that that you don't know whether that would have any impact on snowpack?
Would I agree that I don't know?
No, yes. So remember your deposition testimony? You remember having your deposition taken?
Yes.
And my colleague, Mr. Sturmitz, asked you this question about snowpack. You know what you answered?
I don't. Could you repeat the question that I was asked?
Okay. Under Mr. Sturmitz's question to you in his in your deposition, he asked you the same hypothetical. If Montana ceased any further emission of CO2, would there be an impact on snowpack?
Do you have a page line reference for that?
Yes, I do.
I would say yes.
That you would say yes, that what?
It would have an impact on snowpack.
Okay. Would you agree that you said, I don't know, in your deposition? It's page 19, line 1-6.
Objection, I don't believe the witness has been shown.
She said yes.
Well,
I will show her. I will. I can handle this fairly well.
You need to settle down.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Just refresh your recollection.
What am I looking at here? OGB.
The highlighted part.
Yes.
It is, yeah.
I'm going to have a back. Would you agree that in response to that question, you answered, I don't know?
Yes.
Okay. And so under my hypothetical, if Montana ceased emitting any further CO2, we're done. We turned in our tractor keys and our car keys. You have an opinion as to what impact that would have on stream flows?
Yes.
What is it? I don't know.
I would have an impact.
Okay. For the positive?
It would help. It would help ameliorate climate change.
Okay.
Impacts.
But you have no opinion as to the amount, do you?
No.
You don't know that, do you?
I don't know that.
And you do not know if under that same hypothetical, the impact on the droughts in Montana, correct?
Would you rephrase the whole question so I totally understand it?
Taking the hypothetical, that's just where we start at. If we turn in our tractors, no more CO2, do you have an opinion as to that impact on Montana's droughts?
Yes.
And what is your answer?
It would help ameliorate the problem.
Okay, but you don't know what level that would be to, do you?
No, I can't calculate that.
Okay. Same on precipitation, correct?
Same answer.
Same answer on flooding?
The same answer.
Okay. Same answer on, to the extent you can, impact on wildlife?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. And you would agree with me that we've been experiencing floods in Montana for time immemorial.
Yes.
And in fact, are you familiar with the 1964 flood?
Yes.
That was very similar to the Yellowstone flood of 2021, wasn't it?
I believe, at least on the Yellowstone River, the Yellowstone flood is a 1 in 500 year event.
Okay, you know whether the...
Or more, 1 in 500, 1 in 1,000, depends on...
Okay, how about the 64 flood up there in Flathead area in Two Medicine?
I don't know that one.
Okay, thank you, I appreciate that. And are you familiar with the MEPA policy of the state of Montana?
Only as I've read it in the plaintiff's complaint.
Okay. So you don't know what it does. Is that safe to say?
Yeah. It asks for environmental issues to be considered in energy policy decisions.
But you don't know what impact it has on those decisions, do you?
No.
Okay. Thank you. And would you agree with me that climate change impacts all children of Montana?
Yes.
And the fact that it impacts all persons of Montana, correct?
Yes.
May I have a moment with my colleagues?
Yes.
What does it, with regard to climate scientists, what does a 500-year, 1,000-year flood mean?
Well, in reality, it means that we don't understand how frequently those kinds of floods occur, because really you're looking at a historical data set that goes back maybe a century, and looking at what the discharge is of particular floods. And then you're taking that relationship and extrapolating it up to the discharge river stream flow that you're seeing in a particular flood, and looking at how frequently that might occur. And so when you get into numbers like 1 in 500 years or 1 in 1,000, it really means that we don't have a very good data set to understand how frequently those kinds of floods occur.
They're unique circumstances.
In historical times, they're unique circumstances.
And I mean, with regard to other rivers, I mean, let's say the Madison, we haven't experienced any flooding with the Madison. Is that within the last 20 years?
Not of that magnitude, certainly.
How about the Flathead?
Those are both dammed rivers, so no, we haven't experienced those.
Missouri?
Missouri, the upper Missouri's had some big floods, but yeah.
Okay. That's all I have, Your Honor.
Did you want to wait until after?
I'm happy to go through and finish now, Your Honor. The court has mine.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. So let's start shortly. Before the cross-examination ended, you were asked a series of questions where you responded that you didn't know, and these were questions about measurements. In other words, a whole group of people took their keys and threw them away or put them in the pocket. I can't remember what was said. And you were asked if you could measure the effect that would have on snowpack, and you answered you don't know. Why were you responding that you couldn't measure the effect?
Well, measuring snowpack isn't my expertise. Let me just say that much.
Okay. And would that apply to all the other events
measurements
that you asked about?
Yes.
And you were also, I'm showing you a slide from your direct examination, change in Montana annual precipitation. And it was represented to you that there was no precipitation data for periods of time in your direct testimony.
Is this an example of precipitation data that you testified about?
Yes, I did show this in my testimony. This is modeled data showing the historical trends as well as the future.
And you also reviewed this chart with the blue and the green and the various colors. Does this also discuss precipitation data?
It does, yeah. It's a model projection, modeling the past and then into the future. I might know that the models do an excellent job of projecting, matching the observed data.
And I'd next like to, you were asked about EV chargers in Jordan and around the state. Are you an expert in the energy transition, Dr. Whitlock?
No, I'm absolutely not.
But the tenor of those questions seem to be that, in essence, we're stuck with what we got. If we don't have an EV charger, then we can't transition. Is it your view that we're stuck with what we got?
No, I think this is a very exciting time to be living in because there's so much change going on in Montana
and
across the country.
And Montana does have options to install EV chargers, for example, correct?
Indeed, they do, yes.
And do you understand there'll be other experts in this case testifying about what these options are?
Yes.
Mr. Johnson asked you about counties in Delaware. He asked you about counties in Montana. But in your opinion, do all counties, including counties in Montana, have to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions?
They do. This is a large problem. And every ton of CO2 that's emitted is part of the problem.
Your Honor, that's all the questions I have. I'd like to first move into evidence, three exhibits that were referred to in Dr. Whitlock's testimony, exhibit P222. The Montana State Climate Summaries, Exhibit P75, the U.S. Drought Monitor Time Series for Montana, and Exhibit P70, the 2020 Smoke Waves figure from Climate Central.
The only problem is I can't equate them to your exhibit numbers for the base stats of the participants.
May I, even though I'm going to, and then I have one more request, but I will wait for counsel, Your Honor. What I'd like to do, Your Honor, as we saw here, I think it would be appropriate at this point to move in the expert report of Drs. Running and Whitlock. I mean, Your Honor, they've testified about the content in their report. They've showed the diagrams and charts in the report. And I think that it would be very helpful, Your Honor, especially given that counsel has had an opportunity to cross-examine these witnesses about their expert reports, to admit their expert report in evidence.
Well, how long are these reports?
Sure, Your Honor. I believe I can tell you the exact number of pages. If I may, Your Honor, there's the attachments to the report, but the report itself is approximately 40 pages. It is the text of the report. Is 40 pages, but as Your Honor's seen, a number of these pages are made up of
graphs or charts like we've displayed in court today. So it's substantially less than that than text.
Well, we had a motion limine about this, and I mean, don't really want to get a ton of reports in here. If I'm going to let those report in, they're going to be able to offer their report. And it would be, what's your position?
I think the hearsay, the expert reports are generally an invisible hearsay. I mean, Captain Solo is opinion 2021.
Yeah, they definitely are. Because it's a bench trial, we're trying to be a little more efficient, but they're objecting. I'm not going to admit it. I don't think you need to admit it. I think it's that's better.
Okay. Your Honor, may I, for later today, may I provide a 2-page pocket brief on this issue? 2-3-page pocket brief?
Objection,
Your Honor.
Yes. He wants to have a short brief on the issue.
Object, Your Honor, to part of your formal order in the limine, and it's also a clear law out of Canada.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
So, regarding the old way, page 38601, it came from a study, so we would argue that it's hearsay and the foundation of authenticity issue. With regard to P75, same objection, Your Honor, basically it's a study. I think that's it. Which would be the other one?
2.2. And then the other one? 775
and 2.2. It would be the same objection,
Your Honor.
And these are
the
charts?
Yes, Your Honor.
It came from the study, is what they came from.
I'll admit those.
Thank you.
22, P75, and P70 will be the other.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.